You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 27th of January 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and a very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. Coming up in the next hour, I'll be joined by the best-selling writer William Shawcross to assess how society deals with its worst criminals. We'll be talking to the regular Sundance goer Luke Crissell about how the festival's changed in the past decade.
It was a circus, as it's getting more and more circus-like every year.
And we'll be cracking open a bottle to celebrate the discovery of some remarkable shipwreck bounty. All that plus some great music and a dip between the pages of the latest edition of Monocle magazine. That's right here on Midori House on Monocle 24. All that to pack in the next 60 minutes or so, but first of all, let's get the latest global news headlines with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Security forces killed 37 people in Syria today as people in Homs mourned 14 members of a family they said were slain by militiamen in one of the worst sectarian attacks in the revolt against President Bashar al-Assad. The UN Security Council was to meet later to discuss Syria before a possible vote next week on a new Western Arab draft resolution aimed at halting the bloodshed. Dozens of Syrians broke into the Syrian embassy in Cairo today to protest at their government's bloody crackdown. A Syrian diplomat said the group had made it into the embassy's courtyard, breaking into some administrative offices of the building. A suicide bomber detonated his explosive-filled taxi near a funeral procession in Baghdad today, killing 31 people in the latest attack in a Shiite neighbourhood amid rising violence since an Iraqi political crisis erupted in December. Authorities blame Sunni Islamist insurgents for a spike in attacks targeting Shiites in an attempt to stoke the kind of sectarian slaughter which killed tens of thousands of Iraqis at the peak of the war in 2006 to 2007. The European Union and the IMF want Greece to push through more budget cuts before they agree on a new bailout. The country has been one of the main talking points at the World Economic Forum in Davos today, as key figures gather to thrash out plans to spur an economic recovery. Meanwhile, the US Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner praised Eurozone moves to deal with the debt crisis, but said a bigger firewall was needed.
I think Europeans recognize the sort of unfinished piece of that framework is building a stronger, more credible firewall, because without that, you'll be caught in that trap that you referred to.
Job seekers in Madrid expressed little hope in finding work as the latest unemployment figures were released today, showing an historic record of 5.2 million jobless people in the country. The rate jumped 22.85% in the fourth quarter from 21.5% in the third quarter, according to the National Statistics Institute. The rate is the highest in 17 years and stands unmatched by any other country in the OECD, as well as in the European Union. A leading US personal injury lawyer has urged passengers from the Costa Concordia disaster to file individual lawsuits in the United States. Speaking in Munich, John Arthur Eves, a US personal injury lawyer from the Mississippi-based Eves law firm, said every case should have individual attention.
You had some people that got off the boat and it was just a loss of one day for them. They will never suffer any more problems. You had other people that will be traumatized for a long time. And then, of course, we all understand that there will be people who will be traumatized for a lifetime.
In Italy, consumer groups signed an agreement with Costa Cruises to offer about €11,000 to each of the more than 3,000 passengers aboard the Costa Concordia. Russian election authorities have barred liberal opposition leader Grigory Yavlinsky from standing against Vladimir Putin in the presidential election in March, boosting Putin's chances of winning in the first round. Mr. Putin is seeking a new term in the Kremlin despite fraud allegations at polling booths sparking mass riots. He says he's not worried about the calls for him to resign.
I think about ordinary people in Russia. And of course, I see the protest groups, and I think about it, what I can to do with all our citizens.
And the Dutch minority government plans to ban Muslim face veils, such as burqas and other forms of clothing that cover the face, from next year. The ban would make the Netherlands, where 1 million out of 17 million people are Muslim, the second European Union country to ban the burqa after France, and would apply to face covering veils if they were worn in public. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Nick. Now time to take a look at the weather with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
And here's a look at Europe. And freezing cold weather is dominating the scene across a large portion of the continent, from Scandinavia to Germany, and as far south as the northern Greek border. Daytime temperatures will remain sub-zero for days to come. The weather across Western Europe is very different, much milder, with a mix of cloud, sunshine and some rain over the weekend too. The weekend city outlook then: in Paris, 5 degrees with some rain showers. In Milan, 2 Celsius and a rain and snow mix here. Berlin, -1 with a few snow flurries. And in Helsinki, it's 5 below zero and partly cloudy. North America now: a wet Friday in Manhattan and in many other major cities across the eastern half of the US. But the weekend is looking sunny. In fact, sunshine from the Pacific coast right across the continent to the Atlantic seaboard. And very warm weather in Southern California is expected to last all weekend. The weekend city outlook: in Las Vegas, 15 and sunny. Los Angeles, 25 with some breezy sunny weather. New York City, 7 Celsius and sunshine. In Montreal, 0 with a few snow flurries. Here's a look at other world centres. In the Middle East, in the desert, Dubai and Abu Dhabi, sunny skies next few days. Highs of around 24 degrees, so business as usual on the weather front here. Asia Pacific: you might be in Tokyo. On the chilly side, around 4 or 5 degrees, but sunny. In Seoul, barely above freezing. And in China, Beijing, icy by day with blue skies, with night temperatures of minus 10 degrees. That's it. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Just coming up to 7 minutes past the hour here on Monocle 24, you're listening to Midori House.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse é Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 laget, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ei ole kosa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propojala version.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And we begin today's Midori House with the best-selling author William Shawcross. He's perhaps most recently known for his biography of figures such as the Queen Mother and Rupert Murdoch. But his latest book draws on issues very closely related to his own family, but also issues which address one of the most problematic questions faced by Western society. His book, Nuremberg, 9/11 and the Trial of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, examines how cultures which hold themselves as adhering to the rule of law deal with defendants who are ostensibly lawless. And I'm very pleased to say that William Shawcross joins me in the studio today on Midori House. A very warm welcome to you. I mentioned just then that this had a connection to your family. Just briefly explain what the connection is.
Yes, indeed. My father, Hartley Shawcross, was Attorney General in 1945 in the Labour post-war government. And he was, as such, appointed to be the chief prosecutor at the Nuremberg War Crimes Tribunal, which took place very soon after the war. It was a miracle, really. The war ended in May 1945, and by November, they had set up a huge tribunal and everything in Nuremberg, and they had 22 Nazis in the dock, and they had prepared the charges. This was the Americans, the French, the British, and the Russians, who were problematic. But nonetheless, it was an extraordinary achievement to get a trial going in less than 6 months, and it ended the following summer in 1946. And my father was the chief British prosecutor. And I remember growing up in the 1950s, talking to him a lot about it and listening on old-fashioned gramophone records, which were 78 revolutions per minute, they were called, which were very, very fragile gramophone records, which you have to be a certain age to remember. And listening to his speeches at the prosecution, and they were chilling in the way he described the horrors that the Nazis had perpetrated in the massacre of the Jews.
Now, the subject of your book not just necessarily deals with the subject matter of Nuremberg. It basically charts the progress of the idea of a trial and the idea of the administering of justice in the face of lawlessness. Nuremberg was the first place where this really came to light, where you didn't have a criminal trial, you had something more akin to a civil trial, you didn't have a jury, and there was a presumption of guilt before you'd even started. It was a very difficult situation.
No, that's not quite right. It was a military tribunal, you're quite right, but there wasn't a presumption of guilt. I think probably everybody thought that, for example, Field Marshal Goering, who was the most important man on trial, he was certainly guilty, and he was found guilty and executed. Well, he wasn't executed because the night before his execution, he managed to swallow a cyanide capsule, but he was going to be executed. But there was a presumption of innocence. They started with the technical, thought that these people are innocent.
It's a technical presumption of innocence.
Yes, but six of them were not executed. They were given long sentences, and two, I think, or three, were found innocent. So the Russians complained about that. But anyway, it was a fair trial. It was pretty good, I think. And what happened with the reason for this book is that when Obama announced in 2009 that he was going to put Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is the main plotter, presumed plotter, I should say, alleged plotter of the 9/11 catastrophe, mass murder, and who's in Guantanamo, and Obama said, we're going to put him on trial in New York. And the New Yorkers immediately reacted very strongly, saying, we've had Al-Qaeda here on 9/11, we don't want any of them back. And Obama, in the end, had to climb down. Anyway, my American publisher rang me and said, William, your father was the British prosecutor at Nuremberg, so do a short book saying, Nuremberg was how we dealt with the monsters then, how should we deal with them today? That's what this book tries to do. How do you give justice? How does America give justice to these mass murderers, alleged mass murderers?
Of course, your father was working in the time before the Universal Declaration of Human Rights came in and before whole systems of appeals against certain hearings could come in. So the system nowadays is beset with so many different procedures and opinions as well. It's under such close scrutiny. Do you think that's what's changed things?
Well, you're absolutely right. You put your finger on it. In 1945, I think, as I say, the Nazis had a fair trial, but there was no appeal at all against the judgment of the tribunal. And if a Nazi was transported by time machine to the dock in Guantanamo, he would be astonished by the amazing rights and privileges that the American military court, I should say, gives to the defendants in Guantanamo. There certainly is a presumption of innocence there. And anybody, if Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is convicted in Guantanamo, in the trial, which is going to begin in a few weeks' time, he will be able to appeal all the way through the civilian system to the Supreme Court. So he has astonishing guarantees, if you like, and safeguards, which certainly were not accorded to the Nazis.
In the same way that Nuremberg was building the way in which we try the almost untriable in the 1940s, do you think the Khalid Sheikh Mohammed effect will construct the judicial process for the next generation of evildoers?
I think it's a very, very important trial, and the Americans have appointed a chief military prosecutor. In Nuremberg, they had a wonderful man called Justice Jackson, who was a member of the Supreme Court, who really was the sort of organizing force of the trial and put it all together and was magnificent. And now they have a very fine military lawyer called General Mike Martins. And so remember his name, because it's going to become a household word, for those who are interested in justice for the enemy. And he has been serving in Afghanistan and before that in Iraq, trying to develop the rule of law in those countries. And he's a very scrupulous man. I saw him in New York last week, and he's determined to make this make this trial as open as possible and make it a trial that where everyone can see justice is being done and being seen to be done. But as you say, that in 1945, the only human rights organization in the world probably was the U.S. Army and its democratic allies like the British Army. They had liberated millions of people. Now you have lots of organizations like Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, and others, and in America, the American Civil Liberties Union, all of which have strong points of view. And many of them are very critical of the idea of any military tribunal whatsoever. So they will be making a lot of noise about the process and complaints and so on. But I think, as I say, in the end, the the guarantee that this trial will be fair and these people will be treated fairly is that the fact that they can appeal any judgment all the way to the Supreme Court.
At the heart, though, as you mentioned, the fact that it will take place in Guantanamo, doesn't the continued existence of Guantanamo negate the, not the legality, but the legitimacy of any process that goes on there? Because if this was, this is the place that no one wants to have exist anymore.
That's true. That is the attitude of a lot of people to it. And Obama said that he wished to close it. And I think when Obama became president in 2009, there were about 260 people in the Guantanamo. There are now about 170. He hasn't been able to find any countries in the world that can, where the bulk of these people can be taken safely. Some of them are thought to be extremely dangerous and want to kill other Muslims or Americans or Christians or Jews or whatever, and can't be released, and they'll have to be tried slowly. It's taking a hell of a long time, I agree with you. Others, for example, a lot of Yemenis can't be sent back to Yemen because it's unsafe. Others come from countries like China where they would probably be killed if they were sent back. So it's a very complicated thing.
Your father was a prosecutor at Nuremberg. One of the questions that a lot of people ask nowadays is, what is a lawyer's role in defending a mass murderer? Because a lawyer's role, arguably, is to uphold the rules of society, but also to represent one's client. Do you think that attitudes towards that have changed a lot? I mean, how do we defend mass murderers nowadays?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I think my father's view was that if you were a lawyer, you were like a taxi on a taxi rank, and you had to, if you were asked to prosecute, you'd had to prosecute. If you were asked to defend, you had to defend, and you had to make the best case possible for your client. I think there were occasions when he thought, this man is so clearly guilty, and I'm being asked to defend him. I really can't do that. But on the other hand, I'm sure there were also cases where he felt, my duty is to make, under the law, to make the best case for this person, to see that he gets a fair trial, and that's the whole process.
What do you think he would have thought of nowadays of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the processes involved?
I think he would have been saddened by the length of time this whole thing has taken. One of the magnificent things about Nuremberg was it was over in less than a year, and this has gone on for years and years and years, and will continue to do so. And that's been true of also civilian trials of terrorists in the United States. And it's a very difficult process, and it's much, much more complicated now than it used to be.
You say in your book that only America has the power and optimism to defend the world against what are really the forces of darkness. It introduces an absolute key element to the whole thing, which is who has the moral upper hand in this. What did you mean by that statement?
Well, I mean that Al-Qaeda and other Islamist extremist groups which go on killing and killing and killing, mostly Muslims, it had to be said. Scores of Muslims were killed by Islamic terrorist groups in Iraq today. It happens every day. It happens in Afghanistan. It happens in Pakistan. It happens in Syria. It's happening in Libya. And it happens in Nigeria. It's a worldwide scourge, if you like, an evil. And the United States is the only country with the power and really the commitment to deal with it and to take it on and to face it down.
Yet it faces an organisation or a mindset which has the absolute power and commitment to commit itself entirely to Western downfall.
Yes, it does, and it has to be defeated, and that's why the Americans are so important, in my view.
A lot of people might argue the Americans possibly aren't, because they hold themselves so morally superior.
Aren't what?
Aren't in the position to administer justice in a fair way.
Oh, I think you'll see that in this court in Guantanamo. I know you're quite right that Guantanamo is a dirty word to many people, but in this court they will be seen to administer justice in a fair way. And the defense lawyers, they are military lawyers, but they will be determined to, for their own sakes and the sakes of their own personal reputations, to question the government side on every possible occasion. And organizations that I mentioned, like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty, will be looking over their shoulders and complaining if there's any slackening by the defence.
William Shawcross, thank you very much indeed. And William Shawcross's book, Nuremberg 9/11 and the Trial of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, is out now. Thank you very much indeed. Time for some music now on Midori House. This is the Phoenix Foundation and Flock of Hearts. And that was Phoenix Foundation on Monocle 24 and Flock of Hearts. It's 22 minutes past the hour here on Monocle 24. In just a moment on Midori House, we'll be talking about how the Sundance Festival has been changing over the years. Stay with us.
The February issue of Monocle has a warm glow as we look at how charm adds longevity to brands, makes offices great places to work, and keeps people returning to the same restaurants year after year. But there's more.
In affairs and business, there's a bit of an oil theme. We head to Accra to find out whether Ghana can escape the oil curse that's blighted its neighbours. And we visit Santos, the Brazilian city that's using its oil profits to give Sao Paulo a run for its money.
Plus, there's our Japan travel survey, a visit to a jail-turned-craft school in Charleston, a neighbourhood to call home in Stockholm, and a rugged tale from Tehran. The February issue of Monocle is on newsstands now or available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And a warm welcome back to Midori House. Now, in its 34th year, the Sundance Festival prides itself in being the showcase for independent film. This year, however, by all accounts, things feel different. Not one of the films on show have a US distribution deal, but the festival nonetheless seems to have taken on a more commercial turn. Earlier on Friday, I spoke to the writer and veteran Sundance goer, Luke Crissell. I started by asking him what the atmosphere had been like.
It was a circus, as it's getting more and more circus-like every year, and I think this year was just, like, very circus-like. But yeah, if you try to avoid the main... If you avoid Main Street, there's some really exciting things happening at the festival, I think.
When you mean it's a circus, what do you mean by that?
I think, like, you know, this is my seventh year, and as each year has gone by, you know, it becomes more and more an opportunity for corporate sponsors, such as Yahoo and Bing and these companies, to really make their presence felt with cars driving around. I mean, Acura sponsored this year, so everywhere there's Acuras with, like, big things written on the side. And, you know, I don't think a lot of people who went to Sundance this year would actually have seen one of the films that played, unless they happened to have made it or been in it.
You, on the other hand, preferred to squirrel yourself away in cinemas, didn't you?
Squirreling is the best way to put it. I would see 5 films a day, and they start at 8:30 in the morning. And it becomes a big blur, really. You read your notes and you're like, oh, have I really actually seen that film? I can't remember anything about it. But then, you know, kind of it all distills afterwards, I would say, yeah. I do see a lot of films. I think I saw 26 films this year.
Of the ones that you did see, all of the 26, which ones were not a blur? Which stood out as being particularly good?
Well, I think some of the films that arrived on the biggest rafts of hype actually ended up being the biggest disappointments, both critically and commercially, because the big films didn't sell. I mean, 2 of the dramatic films that really came in with a big buzz were one film called Bachelorette with Kirsten Dunst, and, you know, it's basically like a bridesmaid film, 4 bridesmaids, literally, you know, running around and being really mean. And obviously it was touted as a bridesmaid's follow-up, this film Bachelorette. And it was awful. I think everyone unanimously hated it. It wasn't a good film. And then the other one was Red Hook Summer, which is Spike Lee's first film in a long time. And neither film got the distribution. No one offered to pay anything for either film. So I think they're disappointments. Stephen Frears, too, he came back to the festival after 21 years or 20 years. His last time was The Grifters, which got 2 Oscar nominations for Annette Bening and Angelica Houston. And this film, I mean, it was a bit of a catastrophe. It's called Leigh's Favourite, Rebecca Hall and Bruce Willis, about a stripper in Las Vegas who turns to gambling to make some money. And it was really quite bad, and it didn't. No one bought it.
You mentioned just then the idea of distribution. Now, this year was the first time in what Sundance's 34-year history that not one film arrived with a distribution deal, in the US at least. Is that normal?
I think that is... I don't know if it's normal. It's definitely the way I think it's a good thing, I would say, because it gets, you know, makes almost like a level playing field. And when you're watching these films, it's exciting to know that, you know, they haven't got distribution. And like the premiere category, the films which aren't in competition, those films, a lot of those, you know, all this money's being spent at them. But it's when you look to the sidelines and the documentary competition especially, and also the US dramatic competition and the world dramatic competition, you find really special, small films that end up getting bought. And, you know, things like Little Miss Sunshine, which was a few years ago, was bought for $10.5 million, I think, and it was made for a couple of, you know, cans of Coke and a few shoestrings.
Is there anything like that comparable that's come up at Sundance? Because you've mentioned extensively the ones that didn't live up to the hype.
Yeah, I mean, personally speaking, I don't. Not in terms of distribution deals. Nothing. That's one of the things that nothing happened at this festival like that. There was no big banner film. Not a lot of movies. I mean, Fox bought a film called The Surrogate, which had Helen Hunt, who was a sex worker, and John Hawke. And he, you know, it's about someone who's trying to lose his virginity. He's on an iron lung. And, you know, that film was bought for $6 million, but that's pretty much the biggest purchase, I think.
Neither of which sound called... particularly gripping, if I must say so. So obviously, I'd wait to be convinced by the iron lung one in particular.
Yeah, well, that was the biggest purchase of the festival, to my knowledge, thus far. I mean, obviously, it still is running through Sunday, but, yeah, $6 million Fox Searchlight paid for that. But then there wasn't much, you know, there wasn't much else being bought there or anything at all. If you look back and look back at the Sundance Festival's past, it's very different.
When you look at things like documentary, though, they're doing... there's a new film from Joe Berlinger which covers Paul Simon's return to South Africa to commemorate the 25th anniversary of his Graceland album. This is a gesture, isn't it, almost, that you know people will be interested in it, so it adds to the film's bankability because it will it has an instantly recognisable theme to it.
Yes, I think that was definitely the case, and I think in the documentary films, I mean... It was over. I mean, I read, you know, an interview before going in with John Cooper, the festival director, and he said themes need to emerge organically. Like, it's for the festival to, you know, it's for the festival goers to decide, not the festival, not the programmers. But that might be the case, but I don't think you can really avoid themes. You know, there was a definite theme, and that was dissatisfaction with America. Like, the American documentaries all, you know, almost unanimously were kind of like, just really going to town against them, you know, with these really important issues. And for Sundance to give these films that kind of moment in the spotlight, I think really says a lot. You know, it's really important. I mean, one of the big films was directed by Eugene Jarecki, who directed The Fog of War a few years ago, and he had a film called The House I Live In, all about America's war on drugs. And you know, it was incredible to watch, and a lot of the things, especially being British and living in America, to see these issues, like, you know, there was a film about Detroit called Detroitopia. I don't know how you would pronounce that, Detroitopia. It was interesting, but I mean, I think it was definitely the American documentaries which succeeded the most, in my opinion.
And that was a writer and veteran Sundance Festival girl, Luke Crissell, talking to me earlier on. The time is now 29 minutes past the hour. In the next half hour on Midori House, we'll be off to meet the neighbours again and we'll be uncorking a real deep-sea treasure. But before that, a roundup of the latest news headlines from around the world with Nick.
Thanks, Emma. Security forces killed 37 people in Syria today as people in Homs mourned 14 members of a family they said were slain by militiamen. A suicide bomber detonated his explosive-filled taxi near a funeral procession in Baghdad today, killing 31 people in the latest attack in a Shiite neighbourhood. The European Union and the IMF want Greece to push through more budget cuts before they agree on a new bailout. Job seekers in Madrid expressed little hope in finding work as the latest unemployment figures were released today, showing an historic record of 5.2 million jobless in the country. In Italy, consumer groups signed an agreement with Costa Cruises to offer about €11,000 each to each of the more than 3,000 passengers on board the Costa Concordia. Russian election authorities have barred liberal opposition leader Grigory Yavlinsky from standing against Vladimir Putin in the presidential election in March. Jean-Claude Mas, the Frenchman who sparked a global health scare by selling substandard breast implants, was released from police custody today and faces a charge of causing bodily harm. French troops will withdraw from Afghanistan by the end of 2013, President Nicolas Sarkozy said today, after talks with the Afghan President Hamid Karzai, confirming that pull-out plans would not be accelerated after the killing of French soldiers last week. The Dutch minority government plans to ban Muslim face veils, such as burqas and other forms of clothing that cover the face, from next year. And finally, Twitter announced today that it will begin restricting tweets in specific countries, renewing questions about how the social media platform will handle issues of free speech as it rapidly expands its global user base. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Nick, thank you very much indeed. And Nick will be back in a little under half an hour with a full roundup of the world news headlines. Now, the new issue of Monocle is out in the shops, so it's time now to find out a bit more about what's inside it, especially in section E. And I'm very happy to say its editor, Santiago Tarditi, joins me in the studio now. Hello, Santiago. Thank you for coming in. What have we got in store?
Hi, Emma. Thanks for having me here. Well, this issue is very special because besides having one of your favorite recipes,
oh, we'll get onto that in a minute.
We have a recipe for Wiener Schnitzel from an Austrian restaurant called the Schwarzen Kamel that has more than 400 years. So.
For those of us in a time-proofed recipe. For those of us in a desperate urge to find out this recipe for Wiener Schnitzel, of which I am one of them, where is it, please? What page?
This is page 150.
Thank you. Right.
So if you ever crave for a Wiener Schnitzel and you're in Vienna, you know where to go.
It is one of those things that is incredibly hard to pull off successfully. And I've yet to find, I'll throw this challenge out, I've yet to find a decent schnitzel in London.
Wow, that is a challenge.
Once a decent restaurant apparently in Charlotte Street that did a good Wiener Schnitzel, but closed, and that's it. Since then, all bets are off. There is no good schnitzel. But this is yours, obviously. I don't even dare make it because I can't get it right. What is so good about this Wiener Schnitzel, they say?
Well, as I said, this restaurant has been around for 400 years. So, and it's a place where politicians go and traditional families go. It's like the favorite of the creme de la creme in Vienna. So I'm sure it has something good about it. We should ask Kimberly Bradley, who wrote it. But you know who we can ask about our specialist is Ivan Carvalho, because he went to Italy. Well, he is based in Italy, but he went to Parma, Antonio and Fili. A family-owned locksmith that has been making safes and vaults for many, many years. Ivan, hi, how are you?
Good evening, Santiago.
Ivan, tell us a bit about your visit to the Parma Antonio and Fili.
Well, Parma Antonio is a locksmith, fourth-generation, family-run. It's quite interesting because since the economic crisis and everyone's very nervous about their money, and Italy being very cash-oriented society where people like to operate in cash, I was talking to the manager there, and they make safes and bank vaults for both retail banks and private customers. And they were saying while the banking community maybe is not investing with some of the new products, he saw a lot of requests from private individuals to have safes so they could put away their valuables, because people are a bit more nervous in these times.
So is Italy a place where people still like to stash stuff under the bed and will go for cash rather than a credit card?
Maybe the older generation. I think in a few decades, some of that will go away. But there's still, at the moment, there's still very much a cash-oriented society where people like to have lots of banknotes. So if you're a safe maker, at least here, it works out well.
Now, Parma Antonio Fili, they're not just experts in the small scale safe. They've been the safe suppliers to the best, haven't they?
In the past, they've built for bank vaults for the Vatican, for the Bank of Italy, even South America. In their big expansion period in, say, the 1930s, they were building bank vaults for the Bank of Peru, Venezuela, and these vaults are quite impressive. They built the largest bank vault door in the 20s, and it weighs about 60 tons. And it's in a bank in Liguria, here in Italy. And they say that you can actually push it closed with just a few fingers. It's a marvel of technology. And in the magazine, you'll see there's another bank vault that's been photographed, and it looks fabulous. It looks like something that maybe Goldfinger would go and hide his stash of bullion in.
It's absolutely straight out of a Bond movie. You took the word straight out of my mouth. What actually goes into the making of a safe? Because all we ever see is the big metal door.
Exactly, which I thought was very interesting when I went there, because I was expecting tons of steel. But the secret ingredient, if you can call it that, is cement. And the manager that the family brought in, because they're grooming the fourth generation, the manager who's now running at Giorgio Amadeo, he came from Fiat, which used to have a cement division. And cement is the material that they pour into the spaces in between the outer walls, whether it's bank vaults or the safes. And they put these special mixtures in the cement. Now, I wasn't told the exact details of these ingredients, but I did see some things like metal fibers, iron fibers. They do say they put in some bauxite, other shards of steel. There's all kinds of ingredients they put in the cement mixture to help protect against explosive devices or gas that's used to sort of blow open the doors. It's quite interesting.
Ivan, and did you witness these tests with gas and explosives, and how was it? How resistant were the vaults?
No, they some of the things are very proprietary, and so I wasn't able to see some of it, because when they do the formal testing, this is done at a separate facility. I believe it's in Scandinavia, if I'm not mistaken. They also have, for example, patented these money bags, which are used by security agents when they come to the overnight boxes to take cash out, and they seal automatically. So when a security guard comes out of his armored car and he picks up the bag, it closes before he even finishes taking it out of the drop box, and it has special some fiberglass and other materials in the bag which protects it. And then they're also now the manager was telling me they're going to put in the radio ID tags, which will help the agent, so that if the security guard comes out of his armored car and he has to walk 10 meters to the night drop box, and when he gets very close, there's an antenna inside the drop box, excuse me, which will open, which will signal to the bag, which has an RFID tag on it. So the agent has to spend less time sort of putting in a key or pressing a code, because when they're out on the street and they're carrying lots of money, it's a risk for these people.
Yes, I suppose it would be a little unwise, retrospectively, given what we last asked you to tell people how to break one of these safes. Ivan, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That was Ivan Carvalho, who's our correspondent in Milan, talking about Parma Antonio e Figli, who are the locksmiths and safe makers. Santiago Tarditi, you're still with us. You are still on the menu, aren't you, with your basket?
I am, yes.
What's in your basket this weekend?
This weekend we I brought some delicacies from Spain. I was there in the Madrid Fusion food fair. And on my way back, I stopped at the Mercado Sant Anton, one of the newest markets, to bring back some fish roe, the equivalent of the Italian botarga.
So we have fish roe to look forward to be brought into the studio.
Yes,
lovely.
Exactly.
Can't wait for that. And I'm sure it's absolutely delicious, but warm studios probably aren't the best place to store it. Santiago Tarditi, thank you very much indeed for joining us. And if I'm not mistaken, the menu follows directly after this programme on Monocle 24. It's 21 minutes to the top of the hour here. You're listening to Midori House. In just a moment, we'll be looking at a very special lot to be auctioned later this year. Glasses at the ready, ladies and gentlemen. Before that, some music. I Break Horses and Empty Bottles. And that was I Break Horses, Empty Bottles. You're listening to Midori House. It's 17 minutes before the top of the hour. In a moment, we'll be raising a toast to an amazing deep-sea discovery.
Every week, Monocle editor Andrew Tuck looks at cities around the world and the people, buildings and open spaces that make up the urban landscape. With interviews and discussions of the spaces and places we live in, The Urbanist is your very own urban audio retreat. That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24, and also available on our timeshift player at monocle.com, and of course on iTunes.
Now, on an island between Sweden and Finland, this coming summer they're gearing up for an auction like never before. This is because wine, at least 200 years old, has been found in a shipwreck at the bottom of the Baltic Sea. Some brave soul has tasted it, and by all accounts, it is more than drinkable. In fact, some of the stock has already gone into auction, such as a bottle of Veuve Clicquot, which fetched €30,000. Well, I'm delighted to say that on the phone we have Björn Häggblom. He's head of communications of the government of the island of Åland. Björn, thank you very much for joining us on Midori House. Just explain the backstory to this shipwreck. Where was it found?
Yes, good evening. This shipwreck was found in the summer of 2010, just outside the mainland Åland of Åland Islands. And at about approximately 50 meters below, there was an old shipwreck. And there they found some bottles of champagne, about 145 bottles of champagne.
What do we know about the ship itself and why it was carrying such an amazing cargo?
Well, quite frankly, we don't know too much about the ship. We don't know where it came from. We think it might have been heading towards the Tsar in Russia, Alexander II at the time. We know only that all of the things that were on board were really luxury products of the time, such as champagne and grapes and things like that.
So you, as a representative of the government of the island of Åland, must have been tickled pink, so to speak, to say that you'd found this treasure just next door. Who, in fact, owns this bounty and who has the right to sell it?
Yeah, well, it's the sunken ship is an ancient monument and the cargo, therefore, belongs to the government of Åland since it's more than 100 years old. Actually, it's over 200 years old. So these bottles, some of them are kept for museum purposes and others, as you said, will be auctioned out.
Right, so let's get on to these bottles. What is up for sale?
Well, last year we sold only two bottles just to see what they would fetch. And this upcoming auction on June 8th in Åland, we will sell 11 bottles. Six bottles of Juglar, a now defunct champagne house, four bottles of Veuve-Clicquot and one bottle of Heidsieck.
Now, you have tasted these, I'm led to believe.
Well, I have tasted one bottle from one of the bottles of the Clicquot. We had a press event where we had one of the world's most famous champagne experts, Mr. Rika Julien, who tasted on stage a bottle of champagne from the wreck, and we later gave the opportunity to representatives of the media a chance to sample this, and one of the journalists were kind enough to offer me a sip, and well, it was quite an amazing moment to be honest.
Describe what it tasted like.
Well, I think it tasted rather sweet, more like a dessert wine, with, as I remember, hints of peaches and flowers. Well, really quite fantastic, actually.
You sound as if you'd happily go back for another sip if you were allowed. Is that true?
Certainly do, that's for sure.
So I bet you, I mean, gosh, would I ever suggest you would do this? Could a bottle just accidentally never make it to auction and become the property of Åland and accidentally fall off the back of a lorry?
Well, I don't think so. They're quite safely guarded at the moment, so let's hope not. And because when we are selling these bottles at the auction on June 8th, you know, all the surplus will go to earmarked for maritime archaeological work and for the benefit of the Baltic Sea environment. So it's for a good cause as well.
And how much do you actually intend to raise at these auctions?
Well, it's hard to say, but last year we sold two bottles and one of them broke the world record, €30,000 for a single bottle of champagne. So we're expecting, something around that and hopefully another world record.
Who has actually expressed an interest in buying these bottles?
Well, the bottle that we sold last year went to a collector in Singapore. We know that, for example, some other bidders that were interested at the time and bidded against him were some of the most well-known buyers of champagne globally. So I think we will see that the same people might come back and also other people who are wine connoisseurs with obviously a lot of money and an interest in wine.
Do you think some of these bottles will ever actually get drunk, or do you think people will keep them as prizes forever?
Well, I think some will get drunk straight ahead and some might be saved for a special moment or so. But it's interesting because it's not only the world's oldest bottles, really. It's also the most, well, oldest and still drinkable bottles that really taste good as well. So one should drink them if one buys them, I think.
Björn, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That was Björn Häggblom, who's head of communications of the government of the island of Åland, the lucky discoverers of an enormous schooner filled with champagne.
Londonból, ez a Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
De Londres, este es Monocle 24.
London から Monocle 24 です。
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Londres, sino Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Λόντοστα, τέμα on Monocle 24.
Λόντζαδαν, μπουρσε, Monocle 24.
Λόντον καλά, Monocle 24.
And it's time now on Midori House to meet some of our neighbours again. Sandwiched between big chain coffee shops and hidden behind a bus stop, this time we're visiting the Chess and Bridge Shop in Baker Street. Our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco went there earlier today to talk to the owner, Malcolm Payne. He happens to be the chess correspondent for the Daily Telegraph.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
My name is Malcolm Payne. I'm an international master of chess. I write chess for the Daily Telegraph, and I founded the London Chess Centre in 1992. I started it mainly because there was nowhere in London where you could buy a chess set or a chess book and get some advice. And at the time, the only place you could buy chess books or any decent range of chess books was in a grand old bookshop called Foyles, which has now changed radically. But in those days, buying a book of any kind, not just a chess book, was really quite an experience, as anybody who went there will remember. And I thought, well, if people are prepared to buy chess books from Foyles in such an unfriendly environment, perhaps they'd like to come to a shop where they could talk about chess, get some advice, maybe even play a quick game. So I took a bit of a chance and founded the shop and put it in Euston Road. And then more recently, in 3 or 4 years ago, we came here to Baker Street. I think, first of all, Euston Road, while it was a great sort of flagship, if you like, had a big sign and you could see it from all the cars and buses, it doesn't get a lot of people walking about. And Baker Street's a much more busy area, really, on the way to Oxford Street. And also, I guess, we just felt it was time for a change. We wanted somewhere perhaps a little bit more upmarket in keeping with some of the nicer chess sets that we have here, because the old place was looking a bit scruffy. The biggest sellers are traditional wooden, what are known as Staunton-style chess pieces. Staunton, Howard Staunton, was the world champion, or at least the best player in the world, because they didn't have a formal world chess championship in the middle of the 19th century. And Staunton, as the foremost player of his day, gave his design to the pieces that have become used all over the West. They have slightly different pieces in Eastern Europe, and we sell some of those too. But most chess tournaments are played with what are called Staunton pattern pieces. The market for board games, I think, is actually improving in a way, because people are going out a little bit less. Activities at home are becoming slightly more popular. So we're finding that a lot of people are returning to some of the more traditional things like Monopoly and Scrabble, but they're also and Settlers of Catan and all these sort of role-playing games, which are quite popular, because these kind of things are similar to the computer games, but it's not the same when you're playing somebody face-to-face. I think people appreciate that. Playing internet games is great fun, and playing against a computer is great fun, but there's nothing like sitting around and having that personal contact. It's also the same in chess, by the way. I mean, internet chess is hugely popular, but people still like to play each other face-to-face. And I'd say the market for games is actually growing a little bit, which is quite nice. We wouldn't sell video games, shoot-em-up games, Alien Blasters, because actually, you know, this is a shop for people who want to use their brains, really. In a sense, it's the antithesis of that. Although we do embrace all the platforms, so there is actually a very, very nice program called Fritz and Chester, which you can get for the PlayStation and various other consoles. So we do embrace the new technology, certainly, and we have lots of software and things that work on PCs and Macs. But no, anything you get here is going to exercise the grey matter just a little bit. Every day I find perhaps the most interesting game that was played in the world that day or the day before, explain it a little bit and put it in the paper and set everyone a puzzle. Sometimes it's an easy puzzle, sometimes it's a very difficult puzzle, and I actually do that 364 days a year, because nowadays you can see all the important games of chess live on the internet. I mean, literally, chess is broadcast. Every top tournament is broadcast live. So right now, for example, the world's best players are playing in tournaments in Holland and in Gibraltar. And if you go to these websites, you can see all the games live. But for 99.9% of people, these games are quite hard to understand. So what I try and do is explain what these great players were actually thinking when they did it. And I hope I bring it to life a little.
And that was Malcolm Payne, chess correspondent for the Daily Telegraph and owner of the Chess and Bridge Shop in W1 London, a Midori House neighbour and a man arguably the personification of the word cerebral. And that's about all for Friday's edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie, research by Fernanda Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Andrew Carter. In just a few minutes, it's the time for the premiere of this week's episode of The Menu, our programme on great food and drink. I'll be joined by Ted Kravitz in 3 hours for today's edition of the Monocle Daily, beg your pardon, where we'll be examining the prospects of the French presidential candidate François Hollande. The headlines are next. To take us there, we'll play you out with Junior Boys. This is Second Chance. This was Midori House, and I'm Emma Nelson. Bye-bye.